The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
I'm Katie Coleman, a NASA astronaut, and welcome to the International Space Station. And I wanted to bring something up to space with me that would recognize my Irish heritage. And since I'm also a flute player, I thought, why not Irish flutes? And so I had gotten to know the renowned band, The Chieftains, and I asked them if they would mind if I borrowed some of their instruments and I brought them on a little business trip. This lovely wooden flute belongs to Mr. Matt Malloy, and here in my pocket is a tin whistle from Patty Maloney.
Sure you know the tune as Fanny Power. And there we had Katie Coleman accompanied by the Chieftains. And the Chieftains themselves, when they released that, it was called The Chieftains in Space, I think, or in orbit, wasn't that it?
I think you're right.
Okay. Katie, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
We'll go back to your Irish connections, first of all. With a name like Coleman, there's got to be some.
Well, a quarter on each side that somehow adds up to much more than a half.
Okay.
That's the way we say it.
Now, did you grow up in a household that was kind of Irish dancing and all that sort of stuff?
I did not. But, you know, it seems like it was just something that was meant to be, to sort of creep in and be part of our, you know, more modern history. My brother married a woman who and a U.S. World champion dancer. Their kids are all in the World Champion League of Dancing, the Coleman brothers. And in fact, Garrett was a world champion.
Okay.
For Irish dancing.
So your preoccupation was not with things Irish when you were growing up. It was with things scientific.
It's true. And also, my dad was an explorer. My dad was the supervisor of diving for the Navy. And before that, he was in charge of the C-Lab program when I was like, you know, 6 years old. C-Lab meaning it's like capsules under the sea.
Yeah.
And so to me, it was pretty normal that you might live in a place that was kind of dangerous that not many people did.
So what was your academic route finally to becoming an astronaut? Because you went to MIT.
I did. And so it was through science. I got a degree in chemistry and then went on to get a graduate degree, a PhD in polymer science and engineering, which is, you know, material science. I really love chemistry, like the pouring together, making things kind of chemistry. And yet I also like when it's applied to things that make a difference in people's lives. And I liked that in terms of materials.
Okay, so you're now qualified as a polymer scientist, so you know how to make things. But then you joined the military in some form?
The military actually paid for my college because we didn't have money for college.
Yeah.
And then I went on to get my degree and then do my military service.
So this was the quid pro quo.
It was.
They pay for your college if you give them some service.
Some 4 years of service. But then right at the very end of that, I really loved being in the military. My dad had been military, and I loved giving back in that way. Not that everyone has to use that way to give back, but I got selected for NASA.
And now, had you thought about space at all? I mean, were there any inspirational figures that made you think, I could do that?
Not a bit until I was about 20. When I was a junior in college, and Sally Ride, the first American mm-hmm. woman to go to space, came and gave a talk right before her flight. And I just remember the auditorium. I remember what it felt like to slide in almost a little late and to see her on the stage. And, I mean, she looked a little bit like me, to tell you the truth. I mean, we're not that tall and, you know, dark hair, but she looked so sort of normal. And the way she talked about what she did, that she clearly loved, she's passionate about studying science and finding out more.
So she wasn't like a nerdy kind of person that you couldn't relate to, so kind of out there that you couldn't talk to her. She was quite the opposite.
She really was, and just really passionate about sort of being excellent, but also doing more and finding, you know, doing things that really couldn't be done and finding a way to do them.
Okay, so Sally Ride, the first woman to do that, inspired you. And I think that old line is, you can't be it if you don't see it.
I think it's really true. And it's not true for every person, but it certainly was true for me. And I still think that there's just a lot of messages we don't even see out there that tell people who aren't sort of, you know, sort of tall white guys, that this could be them. I mean, when I see a picture of the Mercury 7, I respect that picture and those people. And at the same time, it doesn't say to me, this could be you. And so having somebody say that to you, I think it's like giving you permission.
Yeah. Now, if America had kind of broader horizons, they would have looked at Valentina Tereshkova, who was the first woman in space for the Soviet space program. So there was a role model there, but not maybe because of the Cold War, a role model to be admired.
Well, I'm not even sure it was the Cold War. I mean, if you think of there's many, unfortunately, but fortunately being found, unsung heroes. I mean, there's a movie that people have watched quite a bit called Hidden Figures about Katherine Johnson. Actually, Katherine Coleman Johnson,
okay,
her maiden name. So I always feel a certain affinity. And she's the woman that led the calculations to figure out how to get people off our Earth, you know, out into space and back home safely. And before John Glenn went on his mission, he said, you know, we have these newfangled IBM computers. You can't even get them through the door. How do I know you didn't break it? You know, he didn't say that. But, you know, I want that woman, the smart one, to do those calculations before I climb in that capsule. And I just think that we've changed who we recognize, and we're finding all sorts of really wonderful people in our history.
Now, tell me about how you then become an astronaut. Are you selected? Do you apply? Do they look at the cohort of graduates to say X, Y, or A, B, or C would be good?
I think everything you just said is true. And if you understood all the things, I would have been one maybe sooner, right? But in my case, I apply to the military. But every couple of years, NASA says for the U.S., we could use new astronauts. And that happens in Europe as well. And in fact, there's a woman from Northern Ireland who's in the latest ESA, European Space Agency cohort. And I think it's a really important moment when you are writing that application, because it's a hard thing to do, because you basically really, if you don't tell people who you are, they cannot pick you.
It's hard sometimes to say I'm great.
It is. It is. And to realize that it doesn't have to be, I mean, everything sounds really big when people say it, but realize that the things in your life that you're proud of are probably important and you should write them down.
Now, what about the kind of physical shape you had to be in? Were you in good physical shape? Were you an athlete? Did you do sport?
I was an athlete later in life, meaning not in my high school, but when I went to college. I decided I wanted to do sports, that maybe I could do that. And it turns out I'm actually pretty reasonable at it. I rode crew for 4 years. And so we were actually the lightweight champions at the MIT women's crew team.
Okay. And that's rowing is a pretty good all round exercise for your whole body, your legs, your lungs, the lot, your arms, your shoulders.
And especially teamwork, actually. Yeah. It really exercises teamwork, because you're in this boat with other people. And if everybody is doing everything they can to win, and you're feeling like, oh, this is so hard. I mean, I don't know if I can do this. Well, you don't have room for that. You just have to like be part of the mission and do your best if everybody else in that boat is doing that. And that's very similar to a space mission.
Yeah, and teamwork, I know, is one of your big themes, how important that is. Okay, so you put in this application saying, I'm great, I'm terrific, and they agreed. So they signed you up.
There's some things in between. They talk to a few people, make sure that you haven't made things up, right?
Okay.
And then there's an interview, and there's a 6-day physical with an hour long interview in the middle. And
how much is there to explore the human body? 6 days it took.
They everywhere they can look. I'm just going to say they look,
okay,
because and it's not so personal that they. they want to have people that are good medical subjects, and you are less complicated with certain things out of your history. And also they worry about a history of some things. And
okay.
So I feel lucky to have good eyesight, not very complicated medical history, and to have played the flute, because I think it was a key part of my interview.
Really?
If you've done your homework, you know they're going to ask you, so tell us about yourself starting in college. So I was ready. And they said, tell us about yourself starting in high school. And I was a little sort of like flummoxed. So yeah. I go, well, I studied chemistry and in math, and I played the flute in the band. And one of the guys looks at me, he puts his hand out. He goes, so do you think you could play the intro to Stairway to Heaven? And I looked at him. I said, yes. He goes, good. And he writes it down. And I'm sure this is Hoot Gibson, one of the chief astronaut at the time. And I'm sure he did this to make me feel more comfortable, which he exactly
but
did.
But also they want to find how integrated a personality you are, that you're not just focused on one narrow track, that there are many aspects to your life and your personality.
I would think so, but I think mostly we're all actually, we're all very different. And I think in that interview, they really want to find out who you really are. And it's not so much that you have to be a certain person. I think there are some things, that if it's maybe really clear that you only think about yourself and you could care less about the rest of the world as long as people know what you do, I think that might not be the best way to become one of those.
Because it's going to be teamwork, as you pointed out.
Exactly.
That's so important. And we might come to some of your colleagues later on the space station, but we're still only at the stage where they say yes.
No, it was a big day, though. I mean, I would say it's when they interview people and then they tell you that they're going to call you. And so it starts off with a few thousand people and now you're down to 100 and they're going to call everybody on the same day and tell them yes or no. And the day that phone call came is just this unbelievable job that only special people get. You just can't really imagine that they would call you.
And when you look at the total number of people who've been in space, it's relatively small. It's only a few hundred.
It is. And I'll say not enough is my opinion. And more is better.
Okay. So then you're in the program. How tough was that? I mean, we see sometimes in the movies, they're immersed in water and turned upside down because they may have to escape from the capsule when it splashes down. The G-forces are generated so that you'll have some sense of what it might be like to be sitting on top of a bomb, i.e. the rocket. So how tough was that?
I'd say there's parts of it that were really, really challenging, mentally more so. I mean, sometimes physically, but then you're in the gym addressing that. And it's really, it's learning to lead this life of what if this happens? What if this happens? Are you ready? And will you be able to do that in time? So that when it does happen on the launch pad or wherever, and in fact, on my second launch, we did have an instance where, they're in the countdown and you're within 30 seconds. So the computer's taken over. You really think you're going to go. And we heard the words saying, abort, abort for a hydrogen leak. And I always wondered if I could undo all those connections, seatbelts, and be out of my seat and go to open that hatch, which was my job down there. And you wonder if you could do that fast enough. And there I was, out of my seat, in time to hear the words of 5 parts per million, which is a
tiny,
really
tiny.
I thought,
no
well,
explosion there.
For that, I mean, certainly I was going to wait till somebody said open the door unless it was clear. I should open the door or the hatch. But I was like, oh, I think we better let them open the hatch. Yeah.
Okay, 5 parts per million.
Yeah.
Not a significant leak.
Not a significant leak, but actually significant enough for the engines to have decided, oh, we don't like that, when they actually light, which would have been 2 or 3 seconds later. And now you are sitting on a bomb that has actually sort of started to start, but not started, and you really want to make that all work out.
I was going to ask you, but you've kind of explained about how well trained you are, so that you did that almost like an automaton.
Exactly.
Once the alert sounded, bang,
and
it was done.
Especially for a person who's a chemist in the Air Force. I mean, I had to learn to think in a different way. It was very operational, they call it, where it's, for me, I'm somebody who sees all the possibilities. I always want to change the plan until the last minute. And at a certain point, it's it's safest, it's best to say, this is the plan, we're doing the plan. And if something really weird happens, we will change the plan, but we're not going to just do it to optimize.
Now, I've often fantasized about being strapped in on top of a rocket and it's about to take off and anticipating the massive G-forces I'm going to experience with the acceleration of the rocket. And I'm wondering what my heart rate would be doing. I mean, because you're so well trained, do you kind of stay relatively calm, or is it thump, 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 thump?
It is. There is definitely some thumping that goes on. And it's not so much about the G-forces, because actually on the launch pad, that rocket is fully fueled. You still have the solid rocket boosters. It's so heavy, it can't actually go too fast yet. And the real G's actually come a little bit later, although once you lift off, I mean, you're going 100 miles an hour before you clear the tower. But in our case, on our first flight, we scrubbed, or we didn't get to go 7 times over 30 days. I mean, there are people in my family that don't speak to me still about that, because, you know, they came, we didn't go, all those things.
So it's kind of, here we go again, and maybe this time we'll get off.
You think, oh, I'm just not going to get excited about this. But then you walk out in your long white underwear and you put on a spacesuit and you just can't help but be so excited. So when you're asking about, you know, is your heart racing? It absolutely is, because it's so real when just thinking that you're really going to do that.
Is it terrifying, though? Because, you know, you've seen explosions on the launch pad. You've seen disasters unfold in space, you know, fatalities and so on. So it could be you. Do you know, does that cross your mind at all?
No.
No. You wouldn't do it if it did, I suppose.
Well, it's just that you've made your decision a long time before that, you know, to be on that rocket, and so is your family. And it's about trust. I mean, I trust people to do their best. Going to space is never, ever, ever in our lifetime going to be a safe sport.
Yeah.
There is risk involved, and yet, you know, I like the fact that some of that risk has been mitigated and baited, and that I trust the people have done their best, and that I will get there safely if that's what we can do that day.
Now, one of the parts of the equipment that's so important is the spacesuit, and with Polaris, we've seen a new generation of spacesuits developed, which are lighter, thinner, and have particular articulations that allow freedom of movement within those suits. There was another problem for you. The suit was there, and it was, of course, like the Michelin Man, a bit cumbersome in those days. But it wasn't only that. They didn't make one for women.
Well, you don't need one for women, but everyone needs one that fits.
Yeah.
And when they, it's expensive to make more sizes of spacesuits. And people, you know, even though I'm saying, hey, how come we can't have suits that fit people? I mean, this is not just a suit that you put on. This is your spaceship. In the shape of a human. It is your air, your water, your breathing, I mean, everything, right? Your communication. And so it's really complicated. And once you have one that works, which started back in the Gemini, Mercury, Apollo days, I mean, these worked.
Yeah.
It's hard to change horses, so to speak. And I don't blame people for that. And at the same time, at a certain point, we have to make sure that we have the equipment that fits people so that they can bring what they bring to a job. And I'm not just saying astronaut, but any job.
What do you think of the Polaris program? We saw a civilian, a very wealthy civilian, albeit, outside the capsule.
I like the way they think. And then, I mean, I was when they said, oh, we have a new spacesuit, and I'm just thinking, how could they develop that so quickly? But the bigger picture that they have is that soon we need to be able to send a lot of people to space. And clearly we don't have some of the technologies that are required to do that. There's some questions that are out there that are big. I mean, I tell people part of the reason we haven't gone to Mars yet is that we're not ready, right? And so they didn't actually make an entire, their intent was not like, we're ready, now we have a spacesuit, we could go anywhere. They actually just attacked, and I don't mean just, but they attacked some of the key elements. And so those people who stepped outside were on an umbilical that is taking care of some of those really critical functions. And I don't say that in a belittling way.
So in other words, the old suit, you could go solo because you'd all your life support in that suit without
Correct.
A tether. But this Correct. One still required a tether because life support is coming from mothership.
Right. And on purpose, because it gave them the freedom to test out some isolated things that are really important. And one of those, which is really important, is mobility. And how could they, in a less complicated and risky way, incorporate the ability for people of different sizes yeah. to move? I mean, thinking with the intent of, we're going to have to make more suits fit more people, thousands, in the future. How can we make a start at that? And they did that by sort of taking one bite of the elephant, right? And so they looked at different ways of fabric folding, and I don't have the details of the suit. Yeah, I'm sure they're
some of the. I think they were hand stitched as well. They required
some of it. Yep.
Qualified yep. seamsters or seamstresses to do that job.
The original spacesuits that back in the Apollo days were made by people who made underwear for women.
Okay.
Because they knew how to do all that fitting, right? Anyways, but I really love that they attacked these important aspects. And so I try not to make that suit any more, but also not any less than it was. It's a big step that they did. And the other thing is that, I mean, for Polaris, Jared Isaacman is a billionaire, but he chooses to bring with him now for the second time, not people that are billionaires, but people who have, if he brings them to space, they go on to provide a purpose that's really important. He brought a really reliable pilot, person yeah. who he knew could run the ship while he was outside. And he also brought two women. So two men, two women on this crew. Could have brought friends, whatever. Two women that were astronaut trainers who will then go home with so many more skills and also understand what it takes to be confident in a spacesuit as it continues its development.
Now, you spent quite a long time in the space station. What was the longest duration?
Almost 6 months.
6 months.
5 months, 20 okay. days, not long enough.
And I read that you actually weren't tethered when you slept. You just allowed yourself to float around.
Well, not around the whole space station, but within my cabin, which is kind of the size of like a smallish Doctor Who phone box kind of thing.
So you just, and you could wake up upside down and what difference does it make? There's no gravity.
It's true. Well, I literally woke up every day just going, oh, I mean, just thinking, oh, I am still here. Yes. I mean, it's this magical place in the weightlessness. I say magical because of the lack of gravity. It's not exactly zero gravity, but it's for yeah. the purposes of a human flying down a module and just, you know, kind of giving a little touch here and there with their pinky to kind of tend themselves as they it's kind of like being, and I don't know, the only time I'm on Earth and I feel the same way is if I'm like underwater in the current where the current sort of just takes you and you just feel like you're just one with your environment. And I'm not very graceful down here. That's probably already clear.
Now, the Boeing astronauts who are stranded in quotes on the space station, and people say, oh, the poor things, they'd be dying to get back. And maybe not. Maybe they're
totally not.
Totally not.
Totally not. I mean, it's Sonny and Butch. I mean, they're both people that I know. Sonny and I are friends. And not that I'm not friends with Butch, but and they were assigned to the Boeing capsule as its shepherds for a long time. And the test mission was 8 days long. I mean, to spend that long getting ready and then only get to spend 8 days is criminal. But what's really, I mean, as astronauts, it's really probably small of us, but we live to go to space. And we whine when we don't get to go back now. We want to go back, you know, again and again. And part of that is because the work we do up there is so important. And I'm not just saying that like some line. When you're up there, you can feel that you understand that you are doing experiments that cannot be done down here on Earth that teach us so much about the Earth. And whether you are compacting the trash or doing inventory or actually doing the experiment with fluids that shows you, oh, this is how fluids interact with like a solid interface, like a wall. I mean, it affects everything that involves flow through a pipe, flow through our pipes and our veins. Every test, like a COVID test you take where you put a drop of something and then it climbs up, that's all about what liquids really want to do. And down here on Earth, we don't know. So in space, we find it out. And knowing that you're one of the people helping do those things.
How come then you were able to demonstrate that the flute sounds great in space and the tin whistle?
Well, you know, being a person up there, I think it's so important to show that you're human. And it comes back to what you first talked about. You have to see it to be it, to realize that you know, humans who just, you know, have something to say, which is all of us, you know, belong up there. I'm not, and I think it takes a certain bravery, and it's not the rocket, sitting on the rocket kind of bravery, but, you know, I'm not the most amazing, you know, Irish flute player or whistle player or silver flute player, but I love to play. I love to play with people. And if I didn't make the St. Patrick's Day greeting, I mean, who's going to do that? My Italian crewmate, you know?
Yeah. And how did you get Matt Malloy's flute and Paddy Maloney's tin whistle?
I think it only took them about a second to answer. But the history goes back to Paddy Maloney's son, Patrick, was an intern at NASA.
No.
He's a nanotech guy. He's now a PhD, he's an engineer, he's a brilliant guy. And he was an intern. And so we'd end up at the same pub that, you know, myself, Chris Hadfield, a couple other people. We have an astronaut band, of course. But there's, you know, this whole group of folks that would play at this British pub down in Houston. And, you know, so when the Chieftains came to town and they're going to bring a local group up on stage, we were privileged to be the ones that got to do that sometimes.
And that ultimately led to borrowing the Paddy's tin. Well, it's the old, not quite the penny whistle, but it's the small, cheap and cheerful tin whistle.
Absolutely.
And I mean, Matt's instrument would be rather more expensive.
It's true. And I think it's a true, Matt's was a treasure of Ireland, this E-flat flute. But in picking things to go, you have to sort of trust people. You can't pick people that are going to say, hey, she took my flute to space, would you like to buy it? I mean, you know, it was people who have demonstrated the spirit of just global music, and that music is for all of us for so many years. And so I really loved doing that, taking their flutes to space. I tell people you could play with them too if you took their flutes to space.
Okay. Well, Katie, you're here for Culture Night, and you are also, I know, an advocate of STEM subjects for young girls, particularly because it opens up a whole world maybe that they've never anticipated they might enjoy.
Exactly. And really importantly, I am doing Culture Night with Dr. Nora Patton.
Okay.
We are going to have a conversation because she is someone who's been selected to go to space. And it doesn't, I mean, she's going for a shorter amount of time, but she's going to see that view of the Earth. She's going to bring that back with her and do important experiments up there. And so we're gonna fill people in on that.
Where's the venue for that, do you know?
It's in the Trinity Library.
In the Trinity Library.
Find the large globe. That's where we will be. There's a large globe of the Earth. Hanging from the ceiling. And Matt Malloy is going to come along.
So we'll have a duet.
I think that we'll have really nice music by Matt and a little duet.
Well, your book, by the way, is called Sharing Space, An Astronaut's Guide to Mission, Wonder and Making Change. And Katie Coleman, thank you very much for joining us in studio today.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's so nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Sport next.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.